This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with students from a school in the Bronx about their encounters on a daily basis with law enforcement.
How would you feel if every time you stepped outside, you felt a cop could come up to you, stop you, search you, frisk you, and even take you to the station house? This'll tell you how to fight back.
With the recent rash of grand jury subpoenas being issued against activists, we're joined today by attorney Margaret Ratner-Kunstler to talk about grand juries and what they mean.
We haven't seen this kind of grand jury repression for a few decades, but it's even worse and more insidious now. Is it a wave of new repression coming from the Obama administration?
Stay with us. Michael and Michael, we've talked in the past about the so-called Newburgh Four, four individuals who were arrested in a high-profile case around the 4th of July, I believe.
And they've been on trial here in New York. The allegations were that they had a plant to bomb synagogues in Riverdale, something about a missile at one of the airports. But it was all set up by an FBI informer who promised them millions and millions, well, at least $250,000. These are young kids. They were, some of them, converted Muslims, and it looks like a huge entrapment defense. So the trial's been going on. All this entrapment stuff has come out, and the jury has been deliberating as we speak and record this for some 4 or 5 days.
That's a good sign.
And a couple of days ago, the deliberations were interrupted, and here's why they were interrupted. The jury gets a book of all of the trial evidence. Unbeknownst, at least to some people, someone had put into the book the transcripts of certain phone calls between the defendants and maybe the informant and others that had not been admitted at trial. So they were evidence that was outside of the trial and that may have had some implications about the defendant's guilt or something, who knows what, but they weren't allowed in. And so then, of course, the defense says, we want a mistrial, although they were mixed about that because it's been 4 days of deliberation. So then the question that became is, which jurors read this stuff? How do they talk about it? Could they put it out of their mind? And of course, more or less the expected happened, which is there's no way, I think, in these cases that you toss a 4 month or 3 month or 2 month trial, whatever it is. So the judge questions each juror, did you read it? If you did, can you put it out of your mind? And of course, every juror, except for one, said, I could put it out of my mind. So those jurors got to continue deliberating, 11 jurors, and one juror said, well, what I read, I cannot put out of my mind, and he or she got excluded. So that's where it stands right now. My view is that this is such a serious error that even if they're convicted, this is a reversible error. I mean, that's like the craziest
appeal
thing I've ever heard.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't convict people on evidence that hasn't been brought in.
But the trial's an interesting one. We covered it here before if people want to find out more. During the initial arrest phase and the entrapment stuff was really outrageous. Unfortunately, it characterizes many, many of the arrests of Muslims in this country.
That's absolutely the point.
Michael Ratner, you have a few national security-related updates. Tell us about them.
You know, we've been following for a long time, really since Bush, of course, the torture, Guantanamo, drone killings, that whole series of cases. And the Obama administration has not been significantly better than Bush on almost anything. In fact, you could easily argue it's a continuation of the policy. And we can look at four cases. You don't have to remember every single one of them, but there's that four that illustrate where we are on some of these national security issues. One was the case filed by the ACLU and the Center for Constitutional Rights, which we've covered here, the El Alwaki case. That concerns a drone attack that the Obama administration purposely leaked in terms of it wanting to kill, by drone or otherwise, a Muslim cleric named El Alwaki, an American citizen. Yes, Michael, I think that's important to emphasize here. The guy's living in Yemen, supposedly. The government, or the Obama administration, whichever you wish to call it, put in a brief asking for dismissal of the CCR-ACLU case. First, they said, because we represent the father, he can't really come in and represent his son, which is complete BS. Of course he can, because how can the son come forward? He'll be assassinated. Secondly, they said the court can't even consider this because it's a political question, which is to say the president can do whatever he wants, even to an American citizen living in Yemen. And third, of course, Obama administration took what they usually take, the state secrets defense, saying nothing in this case can be looked at by the court. So here you have it. The president of the United States ordering the murder of an American citizen living outside the war zone and saying that I have unbridled discretion and executive power to do it. And clearly, because the administration appears to have intentionally leaked their plan to murder this guy, that they wanted to test this power and show that we have the right to do this. And that's what they're doing.
It's not like the executive branch of this government, the president and the CIA, haven't murdered people in the past. They've murdered dozens and dozens of state leaders and other important political figures around the country, around the world. This is a qualitative step forward for them because now they're doing it publicly.
We also have some cases directly concerning Guantanamo. The center had gone to court on behalf of two of three people who the government claimed had committed suicide at Guantanamo. We brought a case on behalf of two of the families of the three people who the claim was suicide. And we claimed, and new evidence has come out constantly, that there may have been, more than may, foul play here, and conceivably these three people were murdered.
And was that related to so-called enhanced interrogation techniques?
Yes, it was. I mean, these were people who were subjected at Guantanamo to enhanced interrogation techniques. So, of course, one theory is that all that drove them to the suicide. But in addition, and I shouldn't say the suicide, because a lot of people would say, in fact, our allegation is that these people may well have been murdered. And a lot of evidence came out from that. Unfortunately, the judge, who had dismissed the case once in the district court, we went back to the judge with new evidence of the murders, and the judge said she was going to dismiss it again. Quote from the case that's interesting. It is, as plaintiffs argue, and this is the judge, disturbing that defendants allegedly fought to keep secret virtually all information concerning the cause and circumstances of the deaths, and that the details of an elaborate high-level cover-up of likely homicides at a black site at Guantanamo are now emerging. That's what the court said. Wow. But despite that, the court felt that it was still barred from considering the family's claims because of the national security interests at stake in the case. So here the court is acknowledging that we have new evidence that may indicate high-level cover-up and homicides, and yet we can't go into it.
Yeah, so national security is the security of preventing people from being prosecuted for murder.
So we can blame the courts, but we often understand on each of these cases, we have the Obama administration arguing for the positions that are taken by the courts. Then we had another case that's interesting. A number of years ago, when it was revealed that there was broad warrantless wiretapping across this country under the Bush program, we went to court saying, well, we fit the profile. We lawyers at the Center for Constitutional Rights fit the profile of who's going to be wiretapped. We're in communication with alleged terrorists overseas, et cetera, et cetera. We went to court on behalf of a dozen Guantanamo lawyers, including CCR lawyers and others. The case is called Wilner, who is Tom Wilner, one of our co-counsel, against the National Security Agency. And the Supreme Court recently said that they will not review this case of wiretapping of the lawyers on the Guantanamo cases. The earlier courts had dismissed it, and again, the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to review it. So what you're seeing here is a pattern. El Awlaki, the assassination attempt in Yemen, the government doesn't want us to look at it. The Guantanamo deaths, the court agrees with the government, we're not going to look at it. And the Supreme Court agrees we're not going to look at the wiretapping of the lawyers.
One question, Michael. One could argue, however, on the Supreme Court side, that by not granting cert, it avoids the possibility of making bad law.
Right. It's not on the merits. A denial is not on the merits. But my view of that is it does avoid like five judges or six saying, you know, you can wiretap lawyers, but as it now stands, you can continue to wiretap lawyers. So it doesn't really help us. I'd rather get them to say and really acknowledge the incredible grab for power that's happened in this country, whether it's the murder of an American citizen in Yemen, the murder of people at Guantanamo, or the wiretapping of American lawyers who are working on legal cases. That's the grab for power that's going on. And then as a fourth case, people I'm sure have read about it. It's one that happened in New York. It's the Galeani case, and it has to do with the bombing of the USS Cole in 1998 or so. And in that case, the government wanted to introduce evidence in the trial in New York that Galeani had bought explosives from a particular person. The way they knew that is Galeani had been tortured, and he had given up the name of the man who he bought the explosives from. And that guy, then the government went to him and got him to say, yes, I sold the defendant the explosives. So the question was, could they use evidence that came from torture, which is to say the fruit of what they call the poisonous tree being the torture of the defendant, and then going down and leading to the actual witness at the trial. And Judge Lewis Kaplan, in what sounds at first like a very courageous decision in a federal court, said, no, you can't use that evidence. It's the fruit of a poisonous tree. You got that through exploiting torture or abuse, whatever term he used. We don't allow that in federal courts. So that sounds like, you know, a big victory and everybody's celebrating, and it's true. But at the same time, Lewis Kaplan, the judge, said in his decision, I think he said something to the effect that the government can still try this guy and they may have enough evidence. They probably do. I think the trial is going on as I speak. But even if they couldn't try him, he can be kept indefinitely as an enemy combatant without a trial. So think about that. What are we talking about here? We're talking about show trials. We're talking about the government takes a position and the judges agree. We can keep all of these people as, quote, enemy combatants forever. We never have to try them. But if we get a lot of evidence, we'll try them and we'll show that we're trying people and there's justice in this country.
And even if we lose the trial, we can still keep them
right,
in prison.
That's correct. And even if they went to trial and lost, they can still keep them in prison. Four cases that indicate just how much this country has descended in really into the abyss of barbarism in terms of its legal system.
The Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee has issued a statement on the 25th anniversary of the murder of Alex Oda. Oda was a professor and a poet and a leader of the ADC out in San Diego. He was murdered 25 years ago when a pipe bomb exploded in the ADC office when he opened the door. The ADC always suspected that the Jewish Defense League, a right-wing vigilante organization, was responsible. And the government has never vigorously pursued the JDL. And to this date, no one has been apprehended for the murder of Alex Oda. Well, I have a personal anecdote on this. The ADC retained me and Attorney Jim Lafferty to go visit a witness in connection with this murder. And we visited this witness, who was a former Jewish Defense League member, up in a prison in Rochester, New York. We went in, and the guy was an Orthodox Jew, and he was real smart, active, and he had gotten the prison to change their food regulations so that they would not only serve him Orthodox kosher food, but they would give the Muslims in the prison halal food as well. So the guy was like a hero in the prison. And Lafferty and I walked in, and all these guys are running over to us. Can I get you a Coke, sir? Can I get you a chair? How are you? You know. And we sit down, and they bring out this Jewish Defense League guy. He was doing three consecutive life sentences for a triple murder. He told Jim and I the following story, that he was contacted by the JDL, and he was asked to supply them with explosives so they could build a pipe bomb. And he knew exactly who built the pipe bomb, who planted it, who in the JDL was responsible for the murder of Alex Oda. We thanked him. We told him we'd stay in touch, and we went back to New York City, and we called up the Federal Bureau of Investigation with this information, and we made arrangements to see a federal attorney to tell him what we knew. We meet with the guy the next Wednesday at a coffee shop. Jim and I were sitting there in a booth with the guy, and we lay it all out to him. And he says, this is very interesting, very important. I'm going to do whatever I can to help you. I respect what you guys are doing. I went to a CLE class with Bill Kunstler at Cornell one time. I really respect you guys' vigorous fight for civil rights, and I'm going to help you. And I'm going to call you back as soon as I can and let you know what we're doing about it. Well, it's been 25 years, and we haven't heard from the guy.
Today we're joined by students and teachers of a program called the New York City Lawyers Guild Street Law Clinic Program. This program teaches youth, young people at schools across this city, how to respond to police stops, frisks, and jailings. It's an amazing, amazing program, and today we have some of those students to talk to you about their encounters with the police and some of their teachers who can help us understand how one should respond to the unlawful stop and frisks that sadly are an everyday occurrence for hundreds of thousands in this city. Today we're joined by Paula Siegel and Gabriela Lopez from the New York City National Lawyers Guild Street Law and Racial Profiling Program, and we're also happy to have with us their students from the program.
Joseph Campbell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Welcome.
Could you tell us briefly what school you're from?
I'm from Arturo A. Schomburg Satellite Academy High School in the Bronx.
In the Bronx. And yes. You have had an incident recently with law enforcement. Can you briefly summarize it for us?
Well, in my neighborhood, it's really common for the police to just bother you for no reason, just because they feel like you got into something, or you know about something, or you possibly up to something, or what you're wearing possibly, or your ethnicity or color. So police just run up on me, ask me my name, ask for my ID for no reason. And while they asking these questions, they searching me. And I don't think that they have the right to go in my pockets unless they really have some reasonable suspicion or something, but they do it anyway. And if I don't have none, they send me home. But if I do have some, then you know how that go.
And did you say anything while the police were searching through your clothes?
No. But sometimes they abuse their authority and want to get rough with you so you could get angry and get the talking back, and they take you in and run your record and want to get all in your business. You know how that
so
goes.
So you knew not to provoke them or to respond to their provocations.
Yep.
How many times has it happened to you?
Roughly at least 3 times out of a week, because I live in Far Rockaway, Queens, so my area is kind of small. So you normally run around the same cops, and they normally encounter the same people, and like, didn't I see you the other day, what you doing out here and this and that? Still bother you, though.
Wait, this happened 3 times in 1 week, but did it happen more than that?
Yeah, it's a common routine.
It so happens I don't every get... week?
Yeah, basically.
Joseph, when they stop you, do they write down your name?
Yep, that too. They ask me. They ask me, what's my name? 19.
And this has been going on for how long?
Ever since I came to New York City, at least like 2 years ago.
Have they ever photographed you?
One time they took me in the precinct, took my picture and ran my fingerprints, but they didn't. There wasn't nothing on my record, so they had to let me go.
Did you ever make a complaint about what the cops were doing?
I know people who have. They say something like, "Oh, I'm gonna get your ID number or something. I mean, your badge number." They say, "All right, fine, go ahead, stuff like that." But we gonna win anyway, stuff like that.
So you don't think it's even worthwhile complaining about it? Huh?
I don't think so, unless they really like beat on me or something for no reason, or I felt they did some really outrageous thing. Yeah, I try to take it to the extreme. But these right here are minor problems that all of us black people go through.
Stephanie, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Could you tell us your age and what incidents you've had, if any, with the police in New York?
I'm 18, and I witnessed a lot of, I could say, police brutality. And one time I was coming out of school, just got out of school, and I was walking up the stairs to get on the train. And these two big policemen, they was like really, really bigger than me. They stopped me, but they grabbed my arm. So when I turned around, I was like, excuse me. And they weren't in uniform, but I seen that they were cops. They had a bulletproof vest on. And they told me to come down the stairs. So when I came down the stairs, I asked him what happened. And he was on his walkie-talkie. And he was like, we have her. We got her. She subject fits the description. And he started saying what I was wearing. And this woman, she was about their size, and she was standing in front of a van. She pulled me to the street, and she was like, take off your sneakers. And she just kept asking me, where is it? And I was like, what are you talking about? And she was like, where is it? Take off your sneakers. Unbuckle your pants. So I did everything she told me to do, and then that's when she started to get physical. And she lifted up my shirt. She unbuckled my bra. Like, everybody was outside. All of my friends was there. Everybody was staring at me like, oh, my God, are you okay?
And she lifted your shirt up so other people could see you in your underwear?
Yeah, she lifted my shirt up, and then I had my bra, and then she pulled my shirt back down and unbuckled my bra to make sure like I wasn't hiding anything. And then she pulled me even closer to the car. Like, I was like 2 steps from getting in. And when I went to get in, she was like, no, don't get in. Where is it? Just tell me where is it at. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then she got on her walkie-talkie again, and she was just like, that I'm putting up a hassle. And then she was like, I'm about to take her in. And I was like, where am I going? And then she was like, she started cursing. And she said, if you don't effing tell me where's it at, I'm going to take you to the precinct and I'm going to strip search you. So I was like, you already searched my pants. You searched my breasts. Like, my sneakers are off. She was like, yeah, you could be stashing it somewhere else. Like, if I'll probably put it somewhere. And then, like, when I started crying is when she was like, all right, forget it. And she let me go.
It being what? What do you think she meant by it?
Drugs
is a bigger. Wow.
She was undercover.
Mm-hmm.
Where did that happen, Steph?
On Elder Avenue, right next to the 6th train.
What neighborhood?
In the Bronx. It's like 2 stops away from Park Chester.
And there were witnesses to this
a
event?
A lot. Oh, it was right after school, so like everybody was outside.
Did you ever make a complaint about it?
No.
Why?
Are you afraid?
Yeah. Like, that I've seen that happen a lot, so I feel like they're not going to get in trouble. It's just...
Is the school doing anything to counter this?
don't think so. Like, I think the school only has authority to handle security guards, not the like big police station, NYPD people.
So the police were essentially waiting right outside the school.
Yeah.
And stopped and
right
searched
by the train
you
station.
When you
like,
got out.
It was a big black van, and I was coming up the stairs, and then they just made me get right back down the stairs and put me right in front of the van.
Stephanie, okay. Can you just say your name and what high school you're from?
I'm Stephanie Colon, and I go to Arturo A. Schomburg of Satellite Academy in the Bronx.
Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Jonathan, can you state your full name, your age, and where you go to school?
Jonathan Jeffrey. I go to Arturo A. Schomburg Satellite Academy High School in the Bronx.
Great. Yes. And have you had an encounter with law enforcement in New York City?
Yes. And sometimes I am bothered by it. Most of the time I'm bothered. I find ways to control myself. And I think that's what people don't understand. It's a way that you have to handle it, and it's a way that you have to know how you have to know your rights. And my encounter with the cops was me leaving my house and riding my bike, this route that I take to go to my friend's house. I take this route and I'm going down Watson. The cars are stopped. I beat the light. And I'd seen the cops, and I'd seen them from the corner of my eye. I didn't have to look at them. And it was they wasn't blue and whites. They were regular clothes, black tents, black car. And I passed them, and I'm riding my bike in a section that's where cars are coming for me. And I'm riding right next to them. And it's peaceful. You know, I'm just riding next to them for a minute, just 1 minute. And then they say, hey, pull over. And I look at them. I laugh, and I keep pedaling my bike. And then he says, hey, pull over. You didn't hear me? I said, hey, I'm not gonna pull over. He's like, what? He says, why? He said, why not? I said, because I asked him, like, hey, why you want me to pull over? He's like, just pull over. I'm still on my bike. But then I stopped because I didn't wanna get arrested.
Did they identify themselves as police officers?
No, they didn't identify themselves.
So then what happened?
And then what happens? I stop the bike, I pull over, I put my hands up. You know, and searching, and they say, "Hey, he says, look, just calm down. We're not gonna touch you." And I put my hands down. Then he throws me on car, and then I'm like, "Hey, what's going on here? What's happening?" And he says, "Hey, just be quiet. You got any drugs on you? He says that you got any weapons on you? We don't care about your weed. And I'm like, "Hey, look it. I don't have any weed on me. You guys are unfolding my socks right now, and I'm not liking this because it's a certain way that I had my socks." I had long tube socks. I put my sock all the way inside my shoe so it could look like a short sock. All right, so, and he just pulls that whole thing up, and then he just searched me. And then after they find nothing, he says, oh, you should change your attitude. And I said, you should change your attitude. And then I got on my bike.
You're fortunate that nothing worse happened after that.
No, nothing worse. At the same time, when I know I'm not going to be arrested, you know, I respect them. I don't do anything to make them mad because that's what they can do.
John, how old are you?
I'm 18.
What neighborhood do you live in?
I live in the Bronx. I live in Soundview.
Do you get hassled by the cops frequently?
Frequently, no. You know, it's just the way I explain my character. You know, it's a lot of cops judge characters, and when I see cops and they ride by my neighborhood, and the cops always come down my neighborhood. And they look at me, I look at them, and, you know, you have to give them an expression like, hey, look it, I'm out here, and I'm not trying to get in that car.
You said when we started out that you thought about this a lot. I mean, is that conscious all the time when you're in the streets thinking about that the cops are around here?
I'm thinking about them. I'm thinking about the cops catching the real villains. I'm thinking about the cops not stopping me. Yeah, you know, it's if you keep it in your head, then it might happen. You know, if you're really guilty of something, then you're going to get hassled. But if you're not guilty, you can be free.
I have a question for you. When you responded to the cop, what did you say again when he had you?
I said, hey, what's going on here? What's happening? Yeah. Why are you guys doing this? And he says, oh, we're searching for weapons because, you know, kids got weapons out here. And I tell him, hey, look, what's your name? Then the other guy says, come on, let's go.
What advice do you get from the Street Law Project on how to respond to cops in that situation?
The advice that I get from the Street Law is not consenting to the search. Telling the cops that I do not want you to search me, being that they do it anyway, to talk to your lawyer before you can say anything to them or ask for a lawyer.
Okay.
That's basically it, you know. You don't want to be incarcerated. No, I don't like that. So I respect the cops.
Are there any community officers who actually go out of their way to make good relationships with young people in the neighborhood?
I don't think we have any of those, but if there were, maybe the streets would be more comfortable. But officers have to stay in character, you know. You know, no matter your skin complexion, they're all wearing blue.
That's right.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Hello, Kiara. Can you tell us your full name and your age?
Kiara Avila. I'm 19 years old.
And you're in school?
Yeah, I go to Arturo H. Scrumborough Satellite Academy High School in the Bronx.
Have you seen any of your classmates stopped or hassled by the police?
Yeah, a lot of times.
After school?
Yeah.
What's the response usually? Do classmates just stand there and let them be searched?
Yeah, they just stand there, get searched, and if they ask for ID, they give the ID. And then usually nobody never ever has nothing, so they just let them go.
Do they take their names when they stop them?
Sometimes.
What do you think the purpose of this is?
I don't know.
Have you attended street law classes at your school?
No.
Would you think of doing that?
Yeah. I got some little books they was giving out. I got them at home.
Know your rights mm-hmm. if you're stopped by the yeah. police. I guess one of the main things is they teach you not to resist, but to say, I don't consent to this search.
Yeah. And, like, to always, like, be, not to get an attitude, because that's what makes everything worse.
Yeah, exactly.
Once they get mad, that's when they start being aggressive, cursing at you, getting it in your face.
There's something mm-hmm. very demeaning about having to stand there and put up with that.
Mm, yeah. And pretend to like them.
Yeah, but I think what you said is really profound. You question these guys' authorities, and they come down on you. You know, mm-hmm. you just have to be passive and polite and tell them,
yeah.
I don't consent to the search. I want my lawyer. But you got to be polite. You threaten their authority, and they go after you.
Yeah, they do. Mm-hmm. Once they get mad.
So I saw you have one of your friends handed you a little card. What's that card?
Yeah, from the New York Civil Liberties Union.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
You did great.
Thank you. And what's your name?
Charisma.
Charisma, welcome to Law and Disorder. How old are you?
17.
And you go to school?
Yes.
In the Bronx?
Yes. Arturo A. Schomburg Satellite Academy High School.
Excellent. And have you seen friends being stopped by the police?
Yes.
And what has happened usually?
They usually, like, they go by their appearance and, like, they assume, like, if you're a troublemaker, because from my knowledge, I know that a lot of the cops, they have to have a certain amount of arrests at the end of the month. So they'll pick on anybody just to get, like, it is crime that go on every day, but that doesn't mean just because you look like a hoodlum or something that you're doing something wrong. But yes, they do pick on a lot of people that look like they're trouble.
Do your teachers talk about this in the classrooms at all?
Yes, I took a course with my teacher, Will, about police brutality.
And what did you learn from it?
How unfair cops are and how they mix business with personal and how they say don't bring your work home, but they do the total opposite. Like, they'll bring home to work. They'll be angry and they'll take it out on people, like, that they try to arrest for absolutely no reason.
And they swear a lot, don't they?
Yes. They curse a lot.
Yeah. Well,
you could be as polite as possible and they'll still, like, be rude, and it's ridiculous.
And you see a lot of undercover or plainclothes officers?
Yeah, that's how they get you.
But you know to recognize them.
Yeah, because they, like, they'll probably have on, like, a hoodie, try to fit in with everybody else, and it just don't work.
Your dash jeans.
Yeah.
So isn't it top of your mind every day when you're going about your business that these cops are in the neighborhood and they may hassle me?
Yeah. I don't ever think twice. Like, if I see them, I'll probably, like, walk a little bit slowly than usual just in case they might stop me, because I don't underestimate them. They just might stop me for no reason at all.
What does it say in your T-shirt?
All you need is love.
You could flash that
right
at the officers.
Cops, right?
Who said that, John Lennon?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The Beatles. Yeah.
All
thank,
right.
you.
Well, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Charisma.
You're welcome.
You've got it.
Paula Siegel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Now, you're in law school.
I'm a third year at CUNY Law School, City University of New York's law school.
And how did you get involved in street law?
I used to teach in CUNY's adult and continuing education programs, a lot of programs out in the neighborhoods. And when I started at CUNY as a first-year student, I assumed that something like street law would exist and I would continue sort of my teaching practice, and thought that one of the reasons I was going to law school was to sort of free the law, to make the law accessible. But there actually wasn't a program at CUNY at the time, and so a group of students and I who all had experience teaching or doing street law or sort of other things that fed into this interest got together, and we wrote a curriculum, and we started doing, all going out and doing workshops in communities that we knew, places that we'd come from in our lives sort of before law school, and from there, we sort of, the project kind of grew, and it grew sort of organically. And eventually kind of got its own identity as the street law team. We started reaching out more aggressively, letting people know that we were out there. We got adopted by the New York City National Lawyers Guild chapter. So because we had, once the project grew a little bit, it started having incarnations at each of the law schools in New York City. What we're focused on doing is still sort of freeing the law. So as law students, we go out to communities that invite us or to public schools, or basically anywhere. We'll do a workshop in a park if somebody makes the space for us to do a workshop in a park.
Do you do role playing in the workshops?
Yeah. The workshops are really different depending on where we are and sort of what seems to be going on both in the community and in the particular classroom or the particular space. But we really try to get people to do role plays because it's good to practice these really, really stressful interactions. They're really stressful for me. And I don't get stopped that often. I don't have to live with it.
These things are really stressful for people who are even educated in the law and are lawyers. So mm-hmm. for people who aren't, it's really tough. But give me an example of what you tell people. Let's say you're role-playing. You're sitting, you're approached by two cops, right? What do you do?
We sort of break it down into two types of tools that people have. They sort of have their savvy and their common sense and all of those things that we were just talking about earlier, about being polite and pretending like you like the people and trying to stay calm. And those are really great harm reduction tools. And those are things that you should be aware that you have, and you have even if you don't know anything about the law. So we definitely talk about that, and we try to get people to practice that in a role play situation. And then we also talk about legal tools and sort of legally operative language. So the importance of not consenting to searches and the frustration of not consenting to searches and then getting searched anyway, and why that still matters, because it matters down the line if you ever end up in court, the importance of asking for an attorney, the importance of saying that you're going to remain silent.
And asking for a phone call if you're taken to the station?
Yeah. Though we really focus on the street encounters.
Right.
We don't really focus on after arrest scenarios. We're really trying to give people tools to be able to walk away.
So, Gabriella, what's your work with street law?
Well, I'm the coordinator for the street law project this year. Paula was it last year, and basically that means that I connect people with trainers, and if requests come in to go to different sites, then I send it to trainers and say, hey, who's available? Let's do this training.
So the question we left off with Paula was, in your training and in your work with New York City neighborhoods, do you ever go meet with the cops at all?
I have never experienced talking to police who are uniformed, but me and another colleague met with a former police officer who used to work in the Brooklyn borough, and we spoke with him about kind of different ways that the police would talk to people and different things, like scenarios that might play out, and how we could try to address those in our street law training.
Give me a sense, like in a year, how many seminars, teaching, how much work do you guys really do in the city?
Well, last year we went to over 60 different sites.
Wow.
So I would say probably anywhere from 60 to 75 different trainings that occurred last year.
And if people listening to this show want to have you guys come to them, what do they do? Is there a website? Is there phone numbers they can call?
People want us to come and do trainings, or if they know of people that need trainings, they can email the street law team. That's at streetlawteam@gmail.com, and send a request, and I will try to figure out a time and a place that best works for them and send out trainers.
How do you get funded to do this work?
Well, right now it's all funded through donations, and it's volunteer work. So when people go out and do these trainings, it's fully volunteer work. If people are interested in donating to us, they can go to the New York City's National Lawyers Guild chapter on our website, which is at nlgnyc.org, and donate to our program.
Well, thank you. Please guys. Do. This was great.
Thank you all.
And do you guys think about law school eventually?
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
A total of 12 people were served with subpoenas during last month's FBI raids in Minneapolis and Chicago. The FBI targeted anti-war peace activists and key organizers of demonstrations and marches who have been asked to appear before a grand jury. What is a grand jury? Historically, a grand jury was supposed to be citizens coming together to determine if charges should be filed criminally against someone. Today, it's very different. It's mostly a rubber stamp for what the prosecutor wants. If you refuse to testify at a grand jury, you can be taken to a judge to answer questions. If you refuse to answer the questions, you could be put in jail. To talk more about grand juries, we're joined by attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler.
Margaret, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
You are our resident expert in grand juries, and you've been doing this kind of work for decades, so you've seen the historical impact, especially in the wake of 9/11. Can you talk generally, and we're going to be talking a little bit about the raids that happened to activists, but can you talk generally first about how grand juries have been misused historically to target activists?
Well, the threat of a grand jury subpoena, just the mere threat of a subpoena, has been used since 1968 when the immunity law changed, and I'll explain that a little bit later, to threaten activists with incarceration. The grand jury functions in a very insidious way. Before 1968, if you were subpoenaed to a grand jury and you asserted your Fifth Amendment right, then that really was the end of your participation in the grand jury because you asserted immunity. And if you were given immunity, then you couldn't be indicted.
Now, by immunity, you mean we have a Fifth Amendment right not to incriminate ourselves. And you were asked to speak before a grand jury or to answer questions, and you say, well, I have a Fifth Amendment right not to say anything, and I'm not going to say anything. And that would be the end of the matter. Now, why was that the end of the matter?
Why was it the end of the matter? Because if you were given immunity, then that was the end of the potential for indictment.
Because so immunity meant that you could no longer—
that nothing you say not only could not be used against you, but anything you testified about could not be the subject of a criminal indictment against you.
So they really couldn't indict you anymore.
So they really couldn't indict you anymore. What happened subsequent to that was it didn't prove to be a good tool, obviously, for either jailing or getting testimony from people. So immunity was changed. And the immunity that was once a full immunity became a transactional immunity. And your testimony then was only if you asserted your Fifth Amendment right before the grand jury, then you were given immunity. But the immunity was so tiny, it only covered what you said. Your very words could not be held against you or the fruits of those words. But it was so easy to get around that just by a prosecutor saying, well, this didn't come from this. It came from something else. If you then refused to testify, once you were given this kind of minor immunity, you could be subject to imprisonment.
So let me give you an example. I'm sitting at home one day, and maybe somewhat like the activists who were given subpoenas for a grand jury in Minneapolis or Chicago, and I'm given a piece of paper by served by an FBI agent, but it comes from a United States attorney, and it says, Michael Ratner, you have to go down to wherever the courthouse is, and you have to go into a room with 23 jurors or something, grand jurors, all in secret, I have to walk in that room, and I don't have my attorney in there. My attorney, let's say it's you, Marge, you can stand outside, but I have to go in the room, and I'm in there with the U.S. attorney and these 23 grand jurors, and they ask me questions. They say, Michael Ratner, what's your name? And I say, my name is Michael Ratner. And they say, were you in Chicago on such and such a date? And I say, well, I'm not going to testify because that might incriminate me if I testify. Then they say, okay, don't answer. We'll get you immunity. Then they go get me immunity. They drag me in again. And then they say, what's your name? Or where were you in Chicago on such and such a date? And I say, I take the Fifth Amendment. And they say, well, no, you can't anymore because you've been given immunity. Then I mess around and I say, well, the First Amendment or something, my right of association. But at that point, they can haul me before a judge and do what with me?
This is assuming that you didn't use certain procedures that are available to you before that. But at that point, they haul you before a judge and you have a contempt hearing. The judge says, what are your reasons for refusing to testify? And listens to them. Generally, people assert the First Amendment claims, which are not deemed sufficient to overcome the immunity issues. So the judge then orders you to testify. You go back into the grand jury room. If you testify, that's one thing. If you refuse to testify, you're brought back before the judge, and the judge then holds you in what is known as civil contempt. That means that whatever length of the grand jury, now the normal grand juries are 18 months. The grand jury that we're concerned about today is a grand jury that's in federal grand jury in Chicago that was impaneled in August, and it's a special grand jury, which means that it's twice as long. It's a 36-month grand jury and can be extended because it's called special. Now, that's significant because the time you can, if you are held in civil contempt, it's so-called the keys to the jail are in your pocket. You are in jail for as long as you refuse to testify. It used to be that we would stall and stall and stall, and so if a person refused to testify, there was only 3 months left to the life of the grand jury, and the person would have to only do 3 months. But since grand jury lives are longer, and since this is the beginning of a grand jury, people who refuse to testify and are held in contempt can easily face 36 months in jail or something near that.
They don't get a fixed sentence. It's just they go to jail and the judge says, you're in jail. And as you said,
until you agree.
You have the keys to the jail. If you agree to talk, you can get out.
Right.
They ask you, name all your friends. I mean, that's the kind of thing they'll ask you.
But absolutely, this is called coercion. The point of incarceration is to coerce the person to change their mind.
Right. And that's why it's civil.
But isn't
right.
it punitive?
Of course it's punitive. Yeah. It's punitive because if a person is going in saying, I know I'm not going to testify, then there's no coercion and it's all 100% punitive.
You're not allowed to like torture people anymore. You just go to jail now.
That's all you do is
right.
you
it's
go to
different.
Jail.
It's not like coercion.
But they
in
say
medieval
theoretically
times.
It's not supposed right. to be punitive.
But you know, at that point, after you have served your civil contempt time, you're still potentially subject to criminal contempt. And that has happened
to some of your clients, Puerto Rican clients,
yes.
right?
After they were held in civil contempt and did their civil contempt time, they were indicted for criminal contempt. And a criminal contempt trial is a joke because you've already been held civilly. You've been in a courtroom refusing to testify. So the evidence against you is quite simple. And there really is very little you can do in terms of a justification.
Now, I remember I went to a training that you did a couple of years ago with Bob Boyle, and I remember the advice, do not say anything, even sometimes admitting your address or your name.
Is it in the grand jury?
Is it true that somehow that could be manipulated, that one really shouldn't say anything?
Well, there is the potential of waiving. If you say something, you could waive your Fifth Amendment right by already participating in the conversation. So if you talk, then you might lose the ability to assert your Fifth Amendment and go through the immunity process.
So, Margaret, what's at stake now with these various people in Chicago and Minneapolis being subpoenaed to the grand jury, the FBI going into their homes and taking their BlackBerries and their computers and their records and everything? What's going on?
Well, I think it's kind of really interesting what's going on. I mean, it really represents the tremendous sea change we have in this country in terms of the ability of people to actively oppose this government's policy. This is a situation that if it happened in 1983, for example, with the groups that were opposing the U.S. intervention in Central America and the propping up of various dictators, there were many groups in this country who were joining forces with the progressive groups in Central America and aiding them in various ways. You had the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador. You had people working with the Nicaraguans. You had a whole host of progressive people supporting the progressive movements in Central America. Now, if that happened today, these people would be subject to, as the people who have been subpoenaed to these grand juries, would be subject to very serious criminal actions against them based on the Patriot Act that now is in existence. I'm sure that this audience has heard about material aid, the material aid situation that's happening in this country today.
Materially aiding terrorism, supposedly.
Right. Terrorists are anybody the government designates as a terrorist.
And certainly, for example, the FALN would have been designated terrorist in 1983, and the people who worked in support of the people of El Salvador would have been in the same situation that the people who have been served with subpoenas today are in. It shows you that the FBI was so frustrated by their inability to really do anything against the CISPIS people. I mean, what they did was kind of COINTELPRO because they had no laws to back them up. So they did illegal things against these people to shut them up. They went to their offices, they talked to their employers, they talked to their families, but there was really very little they could do. The worst they could do was to threaten them with a civil penalty for being agent of a foreign power. And they had no other legal way of controlling them. Mm-hmm. Today, you have absolute control over anybody talking or doing anything and communicating with any of these groups.
Right,
that are on those, the terrorists.
Because they just designate them as terrorist
groups. They're designated as terrorists.
Like no real way to challenge it. And so that if you're doing what would have been legal in the 80s, hard to throw you in jail in the 80s. Today, there's very little left that you can do without them getting on your back, is what you're saying.
Margaret, can you explain what it means to be the target versus just getting a subpoena? Were these individuals targets themselves, or were they being called to get information about others?
It's very hard to predict, to say, because we don't know at this point whether they were targets or not. Generally, when you go into a grand jury, if you are a target, at least in the Southern District of New York, you're given a special additional target warning. So then you know that you're a target. I don't think any of the people who received subpoenas to the grand jury know whether they were targets or not.
How many people got subpoenas?
There were 14 subpoenas,
wow.
11 to individuals and 3 to organizations. But, of course, a subpoena to an organization takes a person to
right,
comply
to
with
to
the
it.
Subpoena.
So that's 15. Now, have all 15 been answered already?
Each of the 11 individual persons subpoenaed wrote letters to the Attorney General to saying that they would assert their Fifth Amendment right and that they would not testify. Then that triggers the immunity issue. The Justice Department was not prepared. Sometimes the Justice Department is prepared with immunity orders immediately. Then you know that that's a clear hint that they want to put you in jail as quickly as possible. The immunity orders were not ready yet. So what happens at this point is that the local U.S. attorney is required then to go to Washington and have a discussion with the powers that be to discuss whether immunity should be given. And I think that's what's probably happening now.
We're speaking with attorney Margaret Ratner Kunstler, an expert on grand juries, about the current subpoenas to movement activists in Minneapolis and Chicago.
Margaret, you mentioned that we didn't know, and I think that describes, in general, the grand jury process. It's rather secretive, isn't it?
Yes. One of the aspects of it that's so intimidating is that it is secret. If you go before the grand jury and refuse to testify, or let's say someone testifies partially or whatever it is, there's no way to know what that person said in front of the grand jury. So it's really kind of a very scary thing for the individual who goes before the grand jury because people could think incorrectly that they were fingered or that somebody said something about them, and that's why they were subpoenaed to a grand jury, or that's why they were indicted. It's a very secretive process. You're not allowed an attorney into the grand jury room with you. An individual who testifies before a grand jury can discuss their own testimony outside of the grand jury, but that's the absolute extent of the possibility of exposing grand jury testimony.
Of course, when you're in the room, it's quite intimidating. You go in the room. Let's say I go into the room. Say Margie's standing outside. I go in front of the grand jury. They ask my name. I give my name. And then they ask me, Mr. Ratner, were you in Chicago August 2008? And I say, I want to go talk to my attorney outside before I answer that question. And my attorney has said, every question, come out and we'll discuss the question and you'll go back. I say, well, I want to go talk to my attorney. I said, they said, what are you talking about? You're hiding something about whether you were in Chicago? You know, this is like looks bad for you. Or they'd browbeat you in the room. And let's say you're not an attorney like me, or let's say you're just, you know, a young person who's been put in there. They're going to browbeat the heck out of you. Hasn't that been some of your experience,
Margie? That definitely. You know, if you represent a witness before a grand jury, your main thing is to say, please, please, don't answer any questions. Come out with the question. It doesn't matter what excuse or how you're told that you must be hiding something. Say, you know, what I say is, say my attorney insists that I come out after every question. It's such an intimidating situation to be there alone, to not knowing what you're facing, and then being made fun of if you want to get some attorney to help you through the process.
Now, it's also important we tell people never lie to an agent. And isn't it true that sometimes the danger is that you might answer a question or take it out of context? And hasn't it been the experience that they may use that against you if you maybe don't get your facts right?
You mean never lie to a grand jury, Heidi?
Never lie to a grand jury.
Well, the best thing is never to talk. Mm-hmm. But lying to a federal official is the same kind of thing. If they can't get you on a substantive charge, it's often that they're looking for some mistake that you have made in a conversation, in an informal, even informal conversation with a federal official, that they can get you on an obstruction charge. In grand jury, they could get you on a perjury charge.
Margaret, where is this all going? My feeling is that there's a lot of social turmoil on the horizon in this country. The economy is terrible, and it's not looking like it's going to get any better, and I think there's going to be a lot of action. And my fear is that somehow what's going on now with the attack against social activists who are in solidarity with, say, the Palestinians is somehow going to be turned around and turned inward with these kinds of devices like grand juries.
Well, I don't want to make it sound frightening, except that I think it is frightening. You know, I don't want to, the worst thing we can possibly do is make people afraid to go out on the street to protest, to say what they think, and to fight this kind of thing. And I'm hoping that this is going to be such an overstep on the part of the government that they're going to have to pull back, because sometimes they go just too far and the response of the people is so strong that they have to pull back. And I'm hoping that that's what's going to happen, because right now we're legalizing activities on the part of the government and criminalizing First Amendment activities in a very, very frightening way. And, you know, to make laws that do that is an indication of a terrible direction that we're headed in for this government.
You know, we've had a good response, I think, to these subpoenas in Chicago and Minneapolis. There were demonstrations in support of the anti-war people and the people served in 27 cities. So that shows, you know, a lot of support out there. But at the same time, and I'm sure you've gotten questions, because it's been a number of years that this hasn't happened in. Back in your years in the 60s and back in the 70s and the 80s with the Puerto Rican movement, et cetera, a lot of it happened. And so activists aren't used to any of this. Most people didn't know what a grand jury was, what their rights were.
I think that understanding what's happening now and understanding it in a historic perspective is critically important for activists at this time. And to learn about what their rights are, there are many ways of learning about their rights. There are pamphlets that are available online. You can go online to the Center for Constitutional Rights, to the National Lawyers Guild. All of these places have Know Your Rights pamphlets that I recommend that everybody refresh their recollection about and begin to prepare for possible FBI visits, et cetera.
Well, Margie was the earliest author of one of them. It's been reformulated many times, has gotten bigger and thicker. It's called If an Agent Knocks, The center distributes that, and Margie and Anne-Marie Butrego, I think, at the center were the original writers of that first little pamphlet, which is still fabulous, If an Agent Knocks.
It must be really frightening, even for those of us who are familiar with the Know Your Rights materials and who talk about it. I cannot imagine what I would feel if an agent knocked at my door. I mean, I know I would say the right thing, give me your business card, my lawyer will call you, but I still think for people who are young and haven't experienced this, it must be very frightening.
What happened in the end, late September, with the grand jury subpoenas and the search warrants, those were not the only things. At the same time, it was really a nationwide activity on the part of the FBI, because FBI visits occurred in Michigan, North Carolina, California, Wisconsin, all over the country at the same time that the search warrants were being executed.
That's what makes me think, Margaret, that this decision was made not on a local level, that it was made in consultation with Attorney General Holder and possibly with the White House. And if it wasn't then, it is now.
And what we read in the Chicago-Minneapolis warrants was they were looking at any involvement with FARC, the Colombian organization, with Hezbollah and PFLP, two Palestinian organizations of sorts. But is that was the other raids as well that you mentioned?
Apparently they were all related to foreign travel and to links to the people and the organizations that received subpoenas. What Michael suggested in terms of it being planned, I mean, I think that we had an indication when Elena Kagan argued as Solicitor General in the Holder case, in the Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, and took an even more extreme position than the final decision that came down from the Supreme Court, so broadening the
material support.
Support. But because it was quite clear that she was reading from a script and that something was being planned. And I think that these raids and the subpoenas are a direct result of that decision in that case.
You're saying when she argued, she didn't want to foreclose the possibility that when the FBI went out and did these kind of raids, that the level of work that these people had with these organizations would be too little to get them on material
exactly.
support.
Exactly.
So she left that wide open.
This is a question of basic democratic rights, and if there's enough of a fight back against these people, maybe they'll decide they bit off more than they can chew and we can roll them back.
Well, thank you very much for having me and giving me an opportunity to explain a little. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
You.